Oh, God.
Gender is a very tricky topic, as you probably have noticed. And we've been actually asked to not talk about it and talk about it. So it's tough to go either way. But that said, here's your power tool.
All right. Gender, I will not talk about gender, but my second...
Especially for two white male professional heterosexual dudes. That's really tricky.
Yeah. Endangered species! Never mind. But anyway, just one little caveat. My daughter, who is now on a select soccer team and a total athlete, her first toy that she actually identified as hers, to do the I, me, mine thing, her first self-identified toy was a stuffy. We now, of course, have an entire room full of stuffies. And Ian's first self-identified toy, I swear, was the remote to the TV. I just went, dude, all right. It was cool.
I do want to opine briefly. It's an important comment, which we should have made in the beginning. This is a Zen saying, nothing left out. But the poignant truth is that we cannot help but leave things out. So Rick and I are leaving stuff out all day long.
Because we don't see it.
Yeah,
it's not our experience. It's a limitation of our genetics and our history, just like everybody else's.
Yeah, and so the thing that we can come to, I actually feel the poignancy of that, and it's important, I think, to name that. You know, perspectives are left out here, and we welcome other perspectives, and the one thing you can do is you can not leave out that you will leave things out. See what I mean? And that's, I just wanted to name that for starters. And particularly for people who have been left out, not just felt left out, but they felt left out for a good reason. They were left out.
Right.
To be left out isn't merely a neutral oversight, but is another wounding. And again, I want to name that as a real thing.
I did have one other piece to add to your question about what anatta looks like. And in addition to the integration that Rick was talking about, it goes back to the thing I was talking about a little earlier, because I had a couple of questions came up on that. The anterior cingulate is in the medial structure. It's in the medial structures in the brain, in the midline. There's one on the left and there's one on the right. If you learn the trick of holding concentration without it being self-referential, you have held concentration. Your anterior cingulate is that 2 to 3% greater activation than the rest of your brain. Without making your story, without telling story about it, without it being my concentration or my wounding or my memory or my bad experience or my good experience. So you have disconnected the anterior cingulate from connections immediately in front and immediately behind. And I think that's the trick that they've been talking about, and that's what got me so excited a little earlier today, because I think that we actually do have a picture, as you were asking, and it's a brain that in a functional MRI scan is integrated between both hemispheres and has, for the most part, little anterior cingulate just kind of watching what is going on. So that's sort of that's my intellectual crutch is on the way to being completely blissed out and whatever.
Do you have a picture of that, of a functional anterior cingulate?
We showed it to you earlier today.
The very first one with that orange blob.
That first functional MRI is a Tibetan monk in the middle of compassion concentration, way deep inside. There you go.
What's a step?
What's? Oh, stuffed animal. If you've been to FAO Schwartz, you've seen Patrick the puppy. It's it's an animal this big. Never mind. Okay. Resources for concentration. How many people today had trouble remaining on focus?
Ever.
Yeah. One breath, two breath, gone. Out the door. What I'm going to talk about here is a little bit is just some of the ways to try to help you maintain your concentration in the middle of the practice, because we're not enlightened. We're not the Tibetan monastic in the middle of of a contemplation practice. We're Western people who are learning this stuff. And so we need wheelchairs, wheeled walkers with seats and baskets, crutches, canes, various things to get us down the path. Otherwise, we're not going to go. We're going to be stuck back where we were. So, woo,
it works.
Power.
So, you're sitting there on your seat, attempting to maintain your concentration, and you're getting distracted. And what are the kinds of things that one can use, little techniques to help you maintain your focus, to help maintain this structure, to learn the Chopin prelude of disconnecting your anterior cingulate from the rest of your midline frontal cortex. Okay. So these are like scales, okay? So reorient to each breath as a fresh stimulus. Beginner's mind, don't know mind. This is actually critically important because to reorient to each new breath. Because if you look at when people self-report on when they get distracted, it's the end of the exhale. Boop. Yeah. It's not, in the middle of the exhale when there's something going on and there's some physical changes, they usually don't get pulled off the banana tree by some dopamine distraction. So at the end of the out breath, reorient, new breath, beginner's mind. Suzuki Roshi has a beautiful his instructions for meditative practice are real simple and they're very elegant. Begin again. Relax. Open. Allow. That's it. Boom, boom, boom. And that basically takes you Zen mind, beginner's mind to at each breath. Begin again. Begin again. Begin again. So that's one particular technique to help you down the path. Intensify the contact, more stimulation. Get into details. Get into subtleties. Where this becomes really, really important is in the kinds of objects of meditation that you may not necessarily be comfortable with. Your herniated disc in your lumbar spine. Your migraine. Your thing that you didn't ask for, but that has shown up, and that is despite the fact that you've gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and tried to remain on the breath, this is what's happening. And this is the kind of technique, for example, a mindfulness-based stress reduction teaches as a way to cope with unbearable, constant, irremediable pain. Is actually not to turn away, not to run away, not to make a dragon stronger by leaving it, but to turn and face it and make it the puppy that it actually is. Get into the details. Get into the subtleties. Where is it located? How does it feel? Is it sparkly? Is it sharp? Is it burning? Is it itching? Is it, did it go away? Oh, wow, it wasn't constant. So it's just as ephemeral, just as anatta as any other content of experience. So it becomes something that becomes impermanent, and you can then stay with it, and it would make it the object of meditation. If you're dealing with, if you're fortunate and don't have chronic pain as an intrusive problem, intensifying the contact with the breath. This is where some of the techniques that Rick ran you through on, in terms of breathing as an entire body. Breathing as a certain part of the body. What does the breath feel like in your little toe? You know, and it could actually beginning just to sense the entire body experience of being in the breath as a way of intensifying contact with the entire breath experience. Attend to the breath as a whole is another way to stimulate increasing the stimulation of the object of intention. Really be aware of just the entire experience of breathing. Some people refer to do this particular kind of a practice as being breathed by, rather than doing the action of breathing. Take the agency out of it. Okay, you are being breathed. you know, the eye is immediately extracted from the equation, and breathing is the only thing that's happening. And so that's what, and then you just pay attention or watch that. Move attention among its parts. This is the classic way of hijacking the dopamine circuit that Rick was talking about a little earlier. If you've got a high reward state, well, by voluntarily moving from the in-breath to the out-breath and the out-breath to the gap and then back to the in-breath and then how it feels in my, you know, in my knee and how it feels in my back and how it feels in my shoulders, you voluntarily moved this attention piece. You've maintained that high tonic dopamine in your reward circuit, and you keep from getting hijacked by tomorrow's commandments from your boss. Or what he said or she said last night. I can't say that correctly. He said she said last night. And then finally, if paying attention to the breath in a seated posture is just too difficult, something like standing meditation or walking meditation are actually very effective. I noticed one person today in the middle of the meditation actually stood up. That's another way, by the way, to deal with sleepiness. Is just, you know, is to stand up and then just be in a body breathing while standing. Or walking meditation, where you just pay attention to the mechanisms of walking, you know, footfall by footfall by footfall. Obviously, as you all know, if you've been on retreats and you've done walking meditation, you don't want to do this in the standard run-of-the-mill public out there, because somebody moving at about 0.025 miles per century gets looked at by people. So that creates its own level of social dukkha. But these are ways to increase the stimulation. And also, make an attempt to be satisfied with less. You know, the less stimuli are still rewarding when you've been doing meditation for a while. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, Bach's B minor mass or Mahler's Ninth Symphony. You know, it can be a little quiet, you know, a small piano piece that's played off in the corner. It still has the same kind of grandeur and beauty. So, and that's because the brain gets all these cortical layers. You know, you thicken your cortex, and this has been documented, you thicken your cortex by as much as a millimeter. If you think about that in terms of synaptic density and communication between neurons, that's billions upon billions upon billions of connections. So any particular stimulus is going to have a whole lot more representation in your brain, and it's going to have a whole lot more for the brain to actually grab onto. And in order to be satisfied with less, practice focusing on a neutral object. Neither pleasant or unpleasant. Look at, you know, smaller and smaller pleasures, smaller and smaller discomforts, and look at those. Not magnify them, not make them into, you know, great stories, not tell, you know, big tales about them, but just what is it to be sitting in a warm room? Okay, and not have to worry about, you know, turning the heat up or opening the windows, that the temperature is just right. And just paying attention to that sensation. What's the Goldilocks moment actually feel like? If you're being satisfied with less, recall the truth that if you're being distracted by something and you can't avoid it, that all stimuli are fundamentally impermanent, empty, ultimately unsatisfying. There's no there. There's nothing to hang on. And the idea with this is actually to move toward a sense of disenchantment, which is another way of saying non-clinging. The enchantment of the standard worldview and the standard way that we've been taught to move through our life. When you're enchanted, you're not mindful. When you're enchanted, you're under the spell and therefore under the power of something else. Disenchantment leaves you available to respond to the next moment, clean of any prior biases. Upandita. In the deepest forms of insight, we see things change so quickly that we can't hold on to anything, and eventually the mind lets go of clinging. Letting go brings equanimity. The greater the letting go, the deeper the equanimity. In Buddhist practice, we work to expand the range of life experiences in which we are free.
That's the quote I was attempting to paraphrase earlier.
Yeah. So these are some techniques.